From Sundress Media Productions, this is Spectrum 360. Welcome. Your Spectrum 360 host is Mark Skogman. Spectrum 360 broadcasts live weekly on Mondays at 11 p.m. and online anytime via podcast. Thank you for listening for the next hour. Spectrum 360 is progressive and features political talk and humor and also the arts and popular culture. Spectrum 360 starts right now. Let's get to work.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Any one of you who feels cynical, just consider where we have been.
You want the truth, you should seek it out for yourself. That's what they're afraid of, you.
This is information the world needs to know.
Ask not what your country can do for you. What you can do for your country.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
Thank you. Bless you. This is the end of the meeting. It's the beginning of the movement. Thank you.
Yeah. Hello.
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 Hello. Hello. Hello. Hello.
Quiet, numbskulls. I'm broadcasting.
That's right, folks. Don't touch that dial.
Spectrum 360. Spectrum 360. Spectrum 360.
From the tropical and beautiful Tampa Bay area in the state of Florida on the eastern coast of the Gulf of Mexico.
Got the sun on my shoulders and my toes in the sand.
This is the radio program Spectrum 360 for Monday, the 23rd of June, 2014. Welcome.
You have an incoming transmission.
The revolution will not be televised.
The voice of news information has six.
The purpose of this program is to bring vital news.
I'm your host, Mark Skogman. Welcome.
You imbecile, you bloated idiot.
What? What's going on with my program?
He is the most interesting man in the world.
Yeah.
You're so ugly you could be a modern art masterpiece.
Oh, there they go again. Okay. This is Spectrum 360 for Monday, the 23rd of June, 2014. On Spectrum 360, in this edition, we've got an excellent program for you. We have three main segments. The focus is going to be politics, politics, and politics. Segment one is a panel discussion pre-recorded from the Left Forum at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. From Sunday, the 1st of June, 2014, featuring Christopher Hedges, Cornell West, and Richard D. Wolfe, the economist, with moderator Laura Flanders of Grit TV on the topic Anatomy of a Revolution, Thomas Paine and his writings, including Common Sense. And basically, they're discussing the theme reform and or revolution, imagining a world with transformative justice. That was the theme of the Left Forum for this last conference. And this is, last week we played part one. This is part two. This is one of the most intelligent discussions I've ever heard at a political conference. It's excellent, and it's very topical, very current, and you need to listen. Okay, that's your assignment. Yes, and we've got a taste for you here, too, just so you can find out what it sounds like.
The name we chose for this conference is Reform and Revolution. Faced with a situation that's becoming more and more unequal, unfair, unjust, and intolerable, what are we going to do?
Yes, what are we going to do? That's the question. Also, segment two, after the bottom of the hour and the second half of the program, segment two is a discussion with The panelists that were on Real Time with Bill Maher on Friday, the 13th of June, 2014. Richard Clark, the former National Security and Counterterrorism Advisor for Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush, was on as a panelist. Also, a conservative commentator, and I'm sorry, I don't remember his name. And also, Crystal Ball, an MSNBC commentator. Excellent, very topical, very prescient, and funny. Approximately 5 minutes from Bill Maher. We're going to review what they said. And then, on segment three, well, let's get a little taste of what the dialogue was like on Real Time.
I love the way John McCain blames Obama, because after 13 centuries of the Sunnis ruling the Shiites,
and right,
10 years of us reversing it, of course, the second we changed that dynamic, it was, you know, like when Indiana Jones took the crystal, the big ball was going to roll after him.
Yeah, I agree with that. And then segment three, a speech pre-recorded, it's more like a talk that was pre-recorded on Sunday, the 15th of June, 2014, by U.S. Representative Alan Grayson, who represents the Orlando area in Florida. He was speaking on a conference call to anti-Trans-Pacific Partnership activists that was organized by MoveOn, and he's speaking on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and trade policy. He's very against the TPP, and you'll find out why. Another very intelligent conversation on Spectrum 360. This is part two of two. Last week, we played part one. This will conclude our two parts with Alan Grayson on this program. But we're going to be going on next week with more segments from the left forum from that conversation with Christopher Hedges, Cornel West, and Richard D. Wolf. I just keep listening to it over and over, and it gets more intelligent every time I listen to it. Great, great things to listen to there and ponder. Thomas Paine was a very interesting man. I did not know nearly as much as I do know now about him after going to the left forum. Those three gentlemen were very, very knowledgeable about Thomas Paine. They have a lot to say about what is going on there. But first, let's have a couple jokes. How about that?
As a general rule, things don't end well if the sentence starts, "Let me tell you something I know about the Negro." You don't really need to hear the rest of it. Just a tip for you. Don't start your sentence that way.
Now, I think President Obama was referring to Cliven Bundy, our favorite Western rancher. Or maybe not so favorite. Depends on your point of view, doesn't it? Yes. And, of course, there was Joel McHale. He was also at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. That's what these jokes are from. Here's one from him.
Good evening, Mr. President, or as Paul Ryan refers to you, yet another inner-city minority relying on the federal government to feed and house your family. I'm a big fan of President Obama. I think he's one of the all-time great presidents, definitely in the top 50.
Right.
Please explain that to Jessica Simpson.
Oh, that was low.
You're right. That was low.
I know I'm right. Okay, now to the left forum with our discussion, panel discussion from Sunday, 1 June, 2014.
Brother Chris is rare. Stanley Rimer is rare. Rick Wolf, rare. Eric Foner, rare. We can go, we can call the list because the list's so short. I'm not just talking about making a symbolic gesture. I'm talking about fundamentally committed to your analysis to where white supremacy is an integral factor among other crucial factors, and then you make the organic connection. That's the kind of brother Thomas Paine was, and it is very, very difficult to build on his legacy, even though we have to acknowledge just how crucial that challenge is.
I want to pick up on something that you all just did. When Laura was still speaking before we started, she asked how much change was needed, or some words to that effect, and it was a strong, clear statement, yes. And she asked about revolution, much less strong, much more wobbling. Now, Tom Paine is exactly about that difference. Just as the name of this conference the name we chose for this conference is Reform and Revolution. Faced with a situation that's becoming more and more unequal, unfair, unjust, and intolerable, what are we going to do? And what pain for me, what makes him stand out, is the care that he takes to go right after that question. And the way I hear it is this. We now face, he says about his time, more than enough evidence, decade upon decade, of accumulated outrages, injustices, attacks on our freedoms, our rights, and our security. In a sense, we've tried to address this one and that one, to work out an accommodation here, to get a reform over there. We've been there, and we've done it, and it hasn't worked. And we got to face that. We can't make reforms most of the time because the power structure arrayed against us blocks us. But even worse, when occasionally we get a reform, that same power structure, having lost the effort to block it, now goes to work to undo it, to reverse it, and to go right back to where they were. Therefore, the conclusion Payne reaches and tries to teach the American people then is the same one I think many of us want to teach now. You've got to change the system. Not because it's an alternative to achieving reforms, but because changing the system is the only way to make a reform that's durable. Revolution is the way you complete the reform process, just as it's the condition for the reforms you get to last and to mean what you wanted them to mean when you fought for them. That's why the word revolution rang in Payne's work so powerfully. It's a big change. Not this, not that. We have to say to the King of England, go home. You're out of here. It's over. The British Empire, hundreds of years of dominance. We quit. We're gone. You're out of here. A powerful ending of the colonial relationship that gave this country its modern birth, its whole history. An amazing thing to say to the people to separate. And yet, aren't we in the same? Isn't that the legacy for us too? To finally say, and let me pick up on one theme here, because I know many of you have encountered references to, or if you have a lot of time, you've read the book by Thomas Piketty. A lot of time, it's 600 pages, it takes a long time. And he's a good economist, but as a writer, not so much. Yes, it's in our profession, that's absolutely normal. But his point is the same, isn't it? He says he studied capitalism for 250 years. He and his colleague Saez in California at Berkeley are the go-to statisticians to understand the distribution of wealth and income in the world these days. And his conclusion in that book, Capital in the 21st Century, is that capitalism inherently, anywhere and everywhere it has been established, produces as its inherent tendency a growing inequality of wealth and income. Periodically, he points out, people get so freaked by this that they push back, and we have a reform. And then as soon as it's over, the same capitalism undoes the reform. We all know that, don't we, here in the United States? Because the last 40 years is the undoing of the New Deal. Yeah. There it is, again. And so Payne comes to us, and when Chris said to me initially, let's start with Thomas Paine, now I see what was in his mind. He is teaching us you got to have the courage to make a systemic change. You've been to the reform table. You've tried it repeatedly. You have to learn the lesson. We are at the stage of taking a major new step. So, of course, we're a little nervous, as your hesitant comments to Laura indicated. But the logic now is something we can understand thanks to Payne's pushing through the way Chris and Cornell just said.
I think the thing about Payne that's also very important, and Cornell alluded to this, is language. What the linguists call mutual knowledge. And Steven Pinker has written about this, that language is a vehicle by which reality is filtered through to you. And part of Payne's power, which is the power of all great revolutionary writers, is that he utterly upended that language to the extent that he redefined terms like democracy. Democracy was a pejorative. Republicanism, or the Republic, was a pejorative. And Payne reclaimed those words and gave them a new definition. The other thing, which Cornell also mentioned, which is important about Payne, is that he spoke in the language, or he wrote in the language, of everyday people. Now, that, as a writer, is deceptive, because it's actually extremely difficult. Orwell mastered that capacity. Orwell once said that, you know, I want to be that clear window pane by which people can see through. And Payne did that. And when he writes his response to Edmund Burke in The Rights of Man, he goes after Burke's very florid style. And I think language, and I'll, you know, want to raise this with both of you, is extremely important because we live in a society now where those who have power have created specialized vocabularies that shut the rest of us out. Economists have been particularly good at this, but just about the technocrat, and we are ruled by technocrats, has created a specialized vocabulary that those of us on the outside are not able to penetrate. And that becomes a kind of barrier in terms of our ability to exercise our rights as citizens to influence power. And Payne understood that extremely well. And it's why his writings were so effective. He's an incredible writer. I mean, Common Sense is arguably one of the greatest essays in English. When he writes The Rights of Man, especially the second part, and it becomes extremely important because in that second part of The Rights of Man, he actually outlines the whole welfare state. And the Pitt government goes nuts, William Pitt, and they pass the two-act law, which bans, just as we see in the wake of the Occupy movement, bans large public gatherings, makes it a lot easier to prosecute people for treason. Payne himself is tried for sedition and has to flee to France. I mean, he has an amazing life. He ends up as one of two foreign delegates in the National Convention, stands up and opposes the regicide of Louis XVI. The Jacobins turn on him. He ends up in prison. But when he writes The Rights of Man, he gives to the English working class, and you have to remember that the working class in England at the time was in far worse economic state than the white working class in the United States. Three out of four people in large metropolitan cities in Europe were either paupers or beggars. And when the Pitt government, it creates all sorts of worker organizations that begin to discuss political issues. The Pitt government shuts it down and drives it underground. But I think, and E.P. Thompson makes this point, that one of the reasons Payne is actually better known in England is because he gave them the whole vocabulary to the kind of working class radical labor movement. And I think that that's an extremely important issue, and I think that this gets to Rick's point, is people's reaction, is that we are still in a process of searching for the language by which we can, number one, describe the political and social and economic reality that we are enduring and how to respond.
And I think at the center of that revolution and form and style of Thomas Paine was a genuine anger, a righteous indignation of the conditions of the people that he was fundamentally working alongside and struggling alongside with. Remember in line 24a of Plato's Apology, Socrates says, "Parrhesia was the cause of my unpopularity." Parrhesia is plain speech. unintimidated speech, frank speech, speech that is unafraid. It's the language of the great Victoria Garvin or Malcolm X. It's the language of Dorothy Day, of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. It cuts through the jargon. It cuts through specialized language. It gets at the pain but doesn't remain there because it articulates a vision so that there's an alternative to that pain. That is also what's lacking. And that's what Thomas Paine had. And part of the problem is when we do have persons with those voices, what happens? Well, Thomas Paine went to jail in London. He's pushed out. He's 11 months in prison in Paris, luckily makes it out. When he comes back here, he has a critique of George Washington. He has a critique of evangelical religion in the midst of the First Awakening. And he is completely pushed aside. So oftentimes, persons who have these voices are either in prison, incarcerated, lied on, character assassinated, literally assassinated, or just pushed to the margins and viewed as some isolated icon that one worships rather than views them as part of a movement. Movie Abu Jamal, Oscar Lopez Rivera. We go on and on and on in this regard. You see? So the challenge is, how do we build on Paine's example? But we're living in a much more crypto-fascist state than he was. That's the lesson of Brother Mumia and others. Those who raise their voices, national surveillance state, the national security state is on you. The spies are operating. Folk on the inside, your friends who used to, you thought you could rely on, no, not at all. They're cowardly. They're too conformist. They're too complacent. Who do you rely on then? That's what Thomas Paine was wrestling with most of his life. He dedicates one of the texts to George Washington, right? Next thing you know, George won't get him out of the clinker in Paris. He's living with James Madison in Paris. Then the critique of George Washington is so devastating. George Washington is the icon. When he comes to the state, they won't touch Thomas Paine with a 10-foot pole because his critique of George Washington is so unrelenting, he has pulled the cover on the demagogue. Nobody talks about George. He chopped down the cherry tree. Nobody talks about George. He sacrificed. Wait a minute. Let's tell a story that's honest and candid about George Washington, especially for someone like Thomas Paine, whose view is not just black people, but Thomas Paine in the Eastern Plain of Pennsylvania when indigenous brothers and sisters and went on to write what? They were wiser than the white folk they were talking to. These were my brothers and sisters, these indigenous people. That's a vanilla brother named Thomas Paine talking that way. We don't even have white activists these days enough talking that way with indigenous peoples and brown peoples and black peoples and Asian people. Yeah, we got some in this room. I'm talking about as a movement. As a movement, why? Because you grew up in such compartmentalized, deodorized spaces where you had very little access to black folk and red folk and yellow folk and others, those vanilla suburbs, and went to these nice little elite schools and got sophisticated and so forth, and not any way connected to what these struggles have been. Thomas Paine refused that, and he left school when he was 12 and a half. Now, I'm not recommending that. But that's also a way in which he was not incorporated so easily by the gentlemen of his day who never accepted Thomas Paine, never accepted John Adams, Jefferson. Even when he said good things about him, he was still a commoner. He was still so unsophisticated and raw and coarse. You know, the vicious lies told about his personal hygiene and something. It may not have been a lie. Maybe he smelled a little bit. But I mean, all the lies that were unimportant relative to the issue that he was talking about. That's how rare he was. That's why it's perfect to start with Thomas Paine.
I think also, not to be the good news bearer, but let's be clear. All the people who turned against him along the way, the vast majority of them, we don't even know who they are. What survived was what this man wrote. And it didn't just survive because he was a great writer. He was. And it didn't just survive because he found ways of changing the meaning of words that brought people alive. Incredible skills. Chris is right. One of the great writers, particularly the great writers of revolutionary literature. The reason, though, he survives is that it's the same question. And when you begin to look
as Christendom, and we did for what we could build a lasting conversation around, we found him because he addresses the same issue. What is to be done, if I could borrow the way another important leader posed the question, what is to be done? This is his recognition. And I think we ought to be, for a moment, proud that the United States produced such a person. Proud that we generated someone who could pose the reform and revolution question so dramatically that even though his coming down on the side of revolution, which frightens so many people, returns now to something we want to talk about and that we want you to return to read and learn from, as we have, because there's lots of very powerful insight in there about what it is we face now. And we do in this country face now an extraordinary structure that has done the things that were so upsetting to Paine. One example, referred to by both of all of us. Democracy in those days was a word that akin to chaotic, disorganized, messy, ineffective, negative, negative, negative. Right? We live, in a sense, in a bizarre reversal. Now it's the Holy of Holies. But it's all a fake. We celebrated democracy the way we celebrate cowboys in the old days. A complete fantasy, a makeup, so that we can indulge this desire. As an economist, I keep saying this, and I know some of you heard it from me before. We go to work, we spend 5 out of 7 days a week at our jobs. And when we go to work, which is where we spend most of our adult life, we enter a place in a capitalist society that is the absolute opposite of democracy. A tiny group of people, major shareholders and boards of directors, 25, 30 people, make all the decisions that thousands of employees, not to speak of the communities where these employees work, have to live with. Their participation in those decisions is completely excluded, in principle, in law, and in fact. So we spend most of our adult lives in an institution that is fundamentally...
Okay, there you have it. Part two of our discussion, panel discussion from the Left Forum. On Sunday, the 1st of June, 2014, that was Christopher Hedges, Cornel West, and Richard Wolf. On the second half of the program, we're going to have real-time discussion and Alan Grayson after the break. 5 minutes for commercials and network news. Stay with us. Spectrum 360.
NBC News Radio, I'm Molly Page. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Baghdad calling for a more inclusive government. This is a bloody insurgency cripples Iraq.
Iraq faces an existential threat, and Iraq's leaders have to meet that threat with the incredible urgency that it demands. The very future of Iraq depends on choices that will be made in the next days and weeks.
The FBI announced today that Operation Cross Country has rescued 168 victims of child sex trafficking in the last week. In addition, 281 arrests were made. Veteran backup singer Mary Clayton is recovering after being seriously injured in a car crash. Clayton's manager said in a statement today that the 65-year-old singer sustained severe injuries to her lower body. Clayton was among the backup singers featured in the Academy Award-winning documentary film 20 Feet from Stardom and is recorded with Ray Charles, Carole King, Bobby Darin, and the Rolling Stones. This is NBC News Radio.
We lock some of the world's top car manufacturers in a room together and ask some questions.
Automakers.
Yes.
Who makes the best engine?
Germany. Next question.
Okay, whose car has more style?
The Italians. Che belle.
American made, amigo.
Okay, who makes the best motor oil?
Castrol Edge. Automakers around the world don't agree on much, but they do recommend Castrol Edge. It's more than just oil. It's liquid engineering.
All right, easy one. Who's going to win the FIFA World Cup?
TrueCar.com. It's the new way to buy a car. Hey, it's Leah. TrueCar.com users save an average of $3,000 off MSRP. First, go to TrueCar.com and see what others paid for the car you're looking for. Then, register at TrueCar.com to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Finally, print out your TrueCar savings certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a hassle-free buying experience. Save time, save money, and never overpay. Visit TrueCar.com today. That's TrueCar.com.
The owners of Acapulco Loco, authentic Mexican cuisine, Roberto and Paul, have over 50 years of combined experience keeping customers happy. They have a strong commitment to provide an innovative menu with excellent, authentic food blended together with great service. The entire experience is completed by bringing it all together in a family-friendly atmosphere. Acapulco Loco, authentic Mexican cuisine, is inspired by Roberto's desire to bring authentic Mexican food to the neighborhood. This exceptional cuisine is modeled after the culinary creations of Roberto's mother from their native Acapulco, Mexico. Acapulco Loco is located in the Campus Walk Plaza in Clearwater, 2551 Drew Street, just west of US 19. For more information and a look at Executive Chef Tino's creations, go to acapulcoloco.com. That's acapulcoloco.com. Bring in your Dunedin Blue Jays ticket stub for a free house margarita or a free draft beer.
Who did you let down today? Your wife? Your kids? Well, how about yourself? Take a look in the mirror. If you're tired of your drug and alcohol problem, you need to fix the problem and right now, before you hurt or kill yourself, or worse yet, somebody else. Call the addiction specialist now at the Detox and Treatment Helpline, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If you have private insurance, we specialize in finding you the right treatment. When you call right now, you'll speak to a recovering addict who understands what you're going through right now. Let us help you break your addiction to drug and alcohol before it's too late. This call is completely confidential and free. So if you have private insurance, take 5 minutes of your time. Call right now. I promise it'll change your life. 866-490-3992. 866-490-3992. 866-490-3992. 866-490-3992.
Money, money, money. How much time do you spend worrying about money? What if you could get the things you need without money? You can. It's called barter, and it's the oldest and most enduring form of exchange on the planet. Dave Wagenvoort's book, No Cash, No Problem, How to Get What You Want in Business and in Life Without Using Cash, is the new Bible of barter. In this book, you'll discover a new mindset that can change your life forever. Learn a secret that is said to be known by only 500 people around the world. Gain a new skill set that can make you rich. See how multi-million dollar deals are done behind the scenes, all without using any cash. Complete your first cashless transaction before you even finish the book. Marketing guru Jay Abraham christened Dave Wagenvoort the king of barter. Order Dave's book, No Cash, No Problem, by phone. $18.95 for the soft cover, $28.95 for the hard cover. Credit cards accepted. Call 727-441-3311. 727-441-3311. 727-441-3311. You're listening to the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is the radio program Spectrum 364, Monday, the 23rd of June, 2014. I'm your host, Mark Skogman. We're going to go right to the next segment, and this is from Friday, the 13th of June, 2014, and it's a discussion from Real Time with Bill Maher between Bill Maher and his panelists that evening, which included Richard Clark and Crystal Ball and one other person as well. This is rather interesting discussion about the Iraq War and rather funny as well. Enjoy.
Witnesses. Bill, we cannot clean up every country in the world so that every country in the world is a nice, safe place where there are no al-Qaeda people and no fundamentalists. We can't do that.
Maliki is not an Iranian puppet.
Oh, really?
He is not. No, no, no. And that you see, well, look at the Charge of the Knights, 2008.
How come all of those Iranian troops are in Iraq fighting on his side?
Because he's in an existential threat at the moment, and if America's saying,
he's
F
totally
off,
an
then
Iranian
he doesn't have
puppet.
An opportunity.
I don't know where you're getting
so we're pushing him into that corner.
But of all the lies that we were told about Iraq, I think the worst worst one we're seeing this week come back to haunt us. The worst one, the one I always hated the most, and unfortunately my friend Christopher Hitchens probably agreed with you on this, was that Saddam Hussein was in league with the jihadis, when actually Saddam Hussein was, of course, the bulwark against the jihadis.
Absolutely.
And the irony here is that we got rid of the Sunni secularists, and now the Sunni crazy
but
religious.
He was, right. He was, I can tell you, because I was fighting Al-Qaeda before 9/11. He was fighting Al-Qaeda
of
before.
Of course. Yeah. What we should have done was leave him in power and assassinate his two sons. Well,
and he was a...
That's what we should have done.
And he was bad, a bad guy.
But not as bad as the kids. They were the real evil seed.
Well, and it's interesting.
They were the children of the corn. They had...
He was a really bad guy. But the problem is, and actually I'm happy you brought that up, because I would actually agree with you. You know, Saddam Hussein, this is actually he was not a big supporter of Al-Qaeda.
No,
it was
all
difficult. But the issue is, the situation you face now, had Saddam Hussein been in power now, what would we be looking at? We'd probably be looking at a Saddam Hussein with a reconstituted nuclear program.
No, because we wouldn't have allowed that.
Okay, well, we're allowing it with Iran.
Iran is about to get nuclear weapons,
and then you have Iran.
Excuse me, we're not allowing it. We're not allowing
it. Well, let's see what happens with that.
Well, fine.
Yeah, let's see what happens with that. But Obama, it was in the paper this week that one of the things he says around the White House when the microphones aren't on is, we have to stop doing dumb sh**. just stop doing dumb sh**.
That doesn't mean we shouldn't do anything.
I agree. And that's where drones come in. You know, I mean, a lot of people are against drones, and drones do some bad things. Yeah. But I always say what I think what you're saying, which is there's got to be a middle ground between sending your army and not doing anything. And unfortunately, right. That is...
Right. And again, it is an important point, you know, the consensus. I know a lot of people will be skeptical hearing a young conservative talking about, you know, more action, because I haven't served in Iraq. But I do have friends who have. And, I, you know, you talk about the impact on...
Well,
the
there
way,
you go.
No, wait. But if you talk about
practically
the impact...
like being there yourself.
Okay. But if you... Wait.
I don't know how bombing Iraq again.
Well, who would you bomb? Would you bomb the Al Qaeda? Would you bomb the Iranians?
What would happen then?
Who are we siding with? We would be flying air support for the Iranian troops.
Or the other way.
That can't happen.
But we wouldn't be doing that.
But we would, because they have troops there, and the frenemy of my frenemy is my best friend.
If you have to choose between supporting Iran or supporting Al Qaeda, which side are you going to bomb?
I love the way John McCain blames Obama, because after 13 centuries of the Sunnis ruling the Shiites,
and right.
10 years of us reversing it, of course, the second we changed that dynamic, it was, you know, like when Indiana Jones took the crystal, the big ball was going to roll after him.
I don't know why anyone is listening to John McCain at this point.
It's insane.
That
a guy who got everything wrong.
Unless they want to listen to him and say, okay, let's do the opposite.
Right. I have to move on to a different topic, because, you know, I've been railing against political correctness.
Okay. Wasn't that a good discussion? And I'd like to dedicate this next song to John McCain. And now we're going to go to our discussion, part two, with the talk that Alan Grayson gave two Sundays ago. This is on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and Trade Policy. Very important. Listen, he's got a lot of great stuff to say. Alan Grayson.
Hi, Representative Grayson. I want to really commend you for speaking out on you being hogtied about telling us what an awful trade bill this is. I have one quick question and one question to further elaborate on what you just described. First of all, are you familiar with Lori Wallach's memo from March of 2006 called Debunking the Myth of Mode 4 and the U.S. H-1B Visa Program? And then
no.
I would highly recommend it and talk to Lori Wallach about it, because that's part of the whole trade debacle, is a cheap foreign labor dumping currently going about over between 1 and 1.5 million foreign legal workers every year, while everybody's hand-wringing about trying to create jobs, and it's all perfectly legal. But I'm very disturbed about the executive branch and how it's behaving. It almost sounds like they're trying to do some sort of enabling act on Congress when it comes to trade, since we know that Article 1, Section 8 you know, is basically mandates the role of Congress to legislate this type of stuff. Is there any way that Congress could, like, say, hey, you know, this is our role, and if you don't stop it, we're going to impeach you or pass a law that sort of takes back this, puts the USTR under the purview of a committee in the House? I find it almost a form of enabling act in a way.
Well, time will tell what Congress is willing to do, but the obvious counter move by Congress is just to say no. You know, nobody forces us to relinquish our constitutional authority through fast-track legislation. I personally think fast-track legislation is unconstitutional. But even if we pass it, that still means that we'll ultimately have to vote on these results of the agreements. And I think that the way that they're presented to us at this point will definitely have an impact on our willingness to vote for them on the merits. Everybody feels like we're being rolled. And people don't like that feeling, whether or not they're members of Congress. So I think that I don't think we need to go so far as to impeach anybody, but I think we do need to say, you've done this, you wasted 5 years of your life and our lives in a wholly improper way for goals that are nowhere near in accordance with your democratic responsibility to the people who elected you. And to hell with you. All right, this will probably be the last question. Let's go ahead.
My question is that Paul Krugman had written a piece a couple of months ago that said that basically trade agreements in the traditional sense were absolutely unnecessary in arguing against TPP and TAP. And I guess my question to you is, given that, how much of this is about a real what one would consider a traditional trade agreement, and how much of it is what some would argue about corporate nationhood? In other words, the ability, there are rumors and things have been written that a lot of these sections of this is about really about the corporation, a corporation to go into a country and overturn whatever protective laws they have passed.
Well, I think it's entirely about that at this point. I think Krugman's point is correct and very poignant. Traditionally, trade agreements dealt with three things. One thing is that certain material is just prohibited from being imported. For instance, the original Tea Party that took place before the Revolutionary War arose from a prohibition on the importing of certain products into the United States at the then colonial borders. There were prohibitions as category number one. The second category is that there were quotas. You can import stuff, but you can't import more than X units of stuff. And third, there were tariffs. Tariffs were extremely widespread, basically universal among Western countries from the 17th century onward. Countries acquired enough control over their borders so that they would post sentries at the borders. And if you wanted to import goods into the country, you had to pay a certain tax called the tariff. And the border sentries would have a list of goods, a list of prices, and they charge you 20 cents per pound of salt or 15 cents per pound of cotton and so on. And this was the biggest money maker of all, in most cases, for national governments, because the income tax really hadn't been invented yet. The sales tax hadn't been invented yet, and it was regarded as unenforceable and intrusive. But the one thing governments had to do in order to be able to survive was control their borders, and that meant that they received revenue that way. If you look at the period before the Civil War, virtually every dollar that came into the U.S. Treasury came into the U.S. Treasury as a result of tariffs. And there were major disputes between the South and the North, running all the way from the first Congress all the way through the Civil War, regarding what should be taxed in a tariff and how much it should be taxed. Since the North was essentially an industrial economy and the South was essentially an agricultural economy, their interests were entirely at odds with each other. Hence the Civil War, in part. I mean, it has something to do with slavery, for sure, but there was also a basic economic difference split within the country that had to be resolved one way or the other. So we had prohibitions, we had quotas, and we had tariffs. At this point in the modern world, there are virtually no prohibitions. You are forbidden to import radioactive material into this country, okay? So don't do it. But that's really not on the minds of most people. There's virtually nothing else that you're literally prohibited from importing. Another example of that is the fur of animals that are protected because of the threat of extinction. So threatened animals fur, can't import that either. But with, you know, very, very minor exceptions, there's no such thing as a prohibition any longer, and not just in our country, but virtually any country in the world. With regard to quotas, I don't think I know of any. I mean, there might be some in the agricultural sector at this point, but generally speaking, we just don't do quotas anymore. If you do a quota instead of a tariff, you're essentially throwing away the money that you would have raised by the tariff, and you're accomplishing the same basic purpose, which is to restrain the influx. Tariffs now are minuscule. Virtually all of our trading partners have been through several rounds of tariff reduction through the World Trade Organization and otherwise. We're now on something like our seventh or eighth round of tariff reductions worldwide. And with most of our industrial partners, countries like China, like Germany, like France, like England, like Japan, those countries, when they export to us, typically pay under 5%, if they pay anything at all, under existing rules for tariffs. So the tariffs are just really minor. The amount of money that the government raises has gone from close to 100% of its revenue. I think postage was the remainder in colonial times, or post-colonial times, down to the point now where tariffs are barely a rounding error. In the federal budget, they're just utterly insignificant. They have nothing to do with how the government raises its money now. So we are basically in a post-trade restriction era already. The fundamental restrictions that you run into tend not to have to do with any of these categories. They tend to be perceived, they tend to be debated, and they tend to be over what really constitutes a food or safety or labor concern and what constitutes basically trying to keep the other folks' goods out of your country. So, I mean, just to give you one example, there is a continuing debate with Japan about American beef. And our perspective is that they keep our beef out through applying all sorts of arcane rules to them before they import it. Their perspective is that our beef just isn't very good, and their consumers don't really want it. And it's potentially dangerous because we don't allow in this country any independent testing for mad cow disease. I'm not sure how many of you knew that, but that's actually the case. If you try to do any independent mad cow disease, the Cattlemen's Association will sue you and force you to stop. So, you know, what to us is a trade barrier is to them a health concern. And that's sort of where we are in the modern world at this point, at least among industrial countries. There are plenty of third world countries that still have tariffs, that face tariffs, and, you know, that could be arguably significant, but it's not significant in the grand scheme of things because so much trade is now done by the main countries and so little trade is done by the smaller economies. So this is basically just an excuse to institute and to enforce a corporate multinational agenda, forcing it on us in the guise of the trade agreement. And that was Krugman's point, and I think it's entirely valid. All right, I think that's it for me, unless our moderator feels otherwise.
Well, could your moderator ask one question, Congressman, before you hang up?
Yes, go ahead.
And that's only because a bunch of people were talking about it. The world is buzzing about Eric Cantor's losing his primary election. And do you have any thoughts on that or how, you know, that might affect a vote on Fast Track, for example?
Sure. I think that Cantor lost his job for reasons that show how distracted and bizarre our political system has become. Cantor was a right winger. He was an extreme right winger. He basically was the voice of the Tea Party in the Republican leadership. You look through that leadership and there's no one else in leadership who could even arguably be said to be the embodiment of Tea Party principles. Boehner isn't. Boehner's a corporate Republican. McMorris isn't. I don't know exactly what McMorris is, but she's not a Tea Party person. McCarthy, the whip, is, a Californian and totally out of touch with a, strong Southern sentiment about guns and about the church and everything else that they are all about. So Kissinger was the voice of the Tea Party, for better or for worse, in the leadership, even though he was Jewish and the only Jewish GOP member. And a lot of Tea Party people are fundamentalist Christians, but nevertheless, he was their guy. And he lost his primary race because his opponent falsely depicted him as not really conservative. Cantor is one of those people who you sort of scratch your and say, does he actually believe the stuff he's saying? But the fact is, he said it. And it's just an illustration of how bizarre Republican primaries have come, that somebody who is a genuine conservative is mistaken for a Republican in name only and a fake conservative. I think that there was an excellent reason to get rid of Cantor from everybody's perspective, both Democratic and Republican. But nobody seemed to be willing to actually engage on that subject. The reason why Cantor deserved to lose is because he never gets anything done. My job is that I'm supposed to participate in the passage of laws that improve the country. That's what I'm supposed to do. We do a lot of other things. We raise money for our re-election campaigns. We do that. We send letters to the president sternly advising him to do this or not do that. We conduct what most people would say is an excellent constituent service operation in our district. We collected 3 million signatures last year against Social Security and benefit cuts. So we do other things. But, in the Constitution, clearly what's envisaged is that we pass laws that the president signs, and then the country's better off. And in that regard, Cantor was an abysmal failure. All we ever have gotten to vote on since he actually took power three-plus years ago is utter flagrant nonsense that everybody, thought as soon as it reached the Senate was, as the phrase goes, dead on arrival. So his real failure was that he simply refused to do the job or let anybody else do the job of legislating. And that never came up. So I think it's an interesting situation, but in the end, it's a sad commentary on the inability of our political process to focus on truth or anything of real importance. I take no comfort in saying that, but that's how I see it. As to how it affects Fast Track, I think that Cantor probably was more willing to let Fast Track come to the floor for a vote than whoever is likely to replace him, including McCarthy, because essentially Eric was quite willing to be a tool of multinational corporations and billionaires. I don't know how else to put it. He was, as well as being a Tea Party guy in leadership, he was also corporate America's inside man. And with him gone, and with McCarthy being in a very shaky position, McCarthy has done a really poor job as whip. It's just the Republicans always pick the next person in line. But by any objective standard, McCarthy has done an awful job as whip. He's not going to really improve as majority leader. So he's going to be wondering if he's going to be able to make it back into leadership when we vote on this again, when the Republicans vote on their leaders again in January, or if we manage to take back the majority, if we vote on our leaders in January. And, given that, I think McCarthy is somewhat less likely to put Fast Track up for a vote than Cantor. But it's really reading tea leaves. What ultimately matters is that neither one of them has any interest in actually doing anything useful. And that's sad. All right, so I've answered your question. Yeah. Let me tell you this, folks who are still on the line. You deserve a lot of credit because the greatest difficulty in modern life, whatever you do, whether you're a doctor or whether you're a cashier at a bank or whether you clean toilets, as I used to do when I was in college, whatever your line of work might be, the hardest part of it as a functioning human being and as a citizen is to distinguish things that are important from things that are not important. And we are just utterly mired and swamped and drowning in the unimportant, the nonsense, the BS. You all deserve credit for being able to discern the difference between what's important and what's not important. Everything involved here, everything we've been talking about, Fast Track, the TPP, the transatlantic version of the TPP, and so on, these are all things that already, in somewhat different guises, have had a very, very serious impact on our lives for the past 20 years, ever since NAFTA was passed. These things exist to grease the skids on the destruction of the American middle class. I'm not exaggerating. This is real. So I think you all deserve a tremendous amount of credit for recognizing that and doing your part. I'm sure that there are other people who are watching World Cup soccer right now, but here you are on a cell phone call, exchanging information, getting tips, and trying to be effective citizens protecting the American middle class. So I salute you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Congressman, and thank you for taking time out of not only a Sunday but also a holiday and the days that the World Cup soccer is on, which my husband is watching right now. So we really appreciate you taking the time to share with us and to enlighten us, and we wish you much success as the Senate takes on this bill. We hope the amendment makes it all the way through. Thank you very much.
Keep up the good work. Thanks. Yeah. Bye.
And that was Alan Grayson speaking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and trade policy. Wasn't that great? Very informative. Also, we had a very informative segment from the discussion at the Left Forum featuring Christopher Hedges, Cornel West, and Richard Wolff. We'll have part three of that series next week, along with additional surprise information. And Jay Alexander, my friend, reminded me that Oliver North was in Fort Myers recently and came out against sending troops into Iraq to be involved in this current crisis. Thank you, Jay, for reminding me about that. And also, next week, St. Pete for Peace had a discussion about the Iraq War, a panel discussion, which we will be featuring audio of next week that was recorded tonight. Of course, we couldn't get it on this program because there wasn't enough time to edit it. But next week we will. Okay. See you next week, Spectrum 360.
Well, we will continue at another time.
So goodbye.
Good night, ladies.
Good night, sir.
Spectrum 360 is produced by Sunburst Media Productions and originates from St. Petersburg, Florida. Executive producer, host, audio engineer, and senior reporter, Mark Skogman. Associate producer, Terry Weeks. Spectrum 360 broadcasts live weekly on Mondays at 11 p.m. for 1 hour and online anytime via podcast. To access the podcast, go to www.facebook.com/Spectrum360 Radio Program and click on the program link. Or go to www.tantalk1340.com, click on podcasts, and click on Spectrum 360. Thank you to all our listeners and supporters and the staff of Spectrum 360. Listen next week for another interesting, informative, and entertaining Spectrum 360 radio program.
That's all, folks.